This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In 1986, Father Greg Boyle was appointed to a poor parish in the Boyle Heights neighborhood of Los Angeles. At the time, the area had one of the worst gang problems in the country, and Father Greg thought he'd better do something about it. He joined forces with members of his parish to create a small jobs program. Well, now, more than two decades later, this program has become one of the largest and most comprehensive gang intervention programs in the country. It's called Homeboy Industries and employs former gang members in a range of businesses, from screen printing to farmers markets. Father Greg is a Jesuit priest who's in town as a visiting Keenan practitioner in residence with Religions and Public Life at Duke. He's going to be at a variety of student events and campus groups throughout the week. In fact, we'll be talking together on a panel discussion on Thursday at the Criminal Justice Resource Center in downtown Durham. He's going to give a public talk on Duke's West Campus tomorrow night at 6. But first, right here in our studio, Father Greg Boyle, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
Take us back to your early days in Boyle Heights. You're a new pastor at the time. So what was that like? What did you see when you took over that parish?
Well, I think initially, you know, we were dealing with immigration issues, as I look back, probably the first 2 years. But then began what I would call the decade of death, which was 88 to 98. And we had shootings morning, noon, and night. And I buried my first young person killed because of gang violence in 88. And a month ago, I buried my 202nd. So we had to do something. So it was either bury your head in the sand or roll up your sleeves. So we kind of thought, well, let's try to understand what language this violence was speaking. We started a school first because there were so many middle school age gang members who had been given the boot from their home school and nobody wanted them. So they were wreaking havoc in the projects. And so one thing led to another. Now we've evolved over 28 years, and we're in our fourth location, fourth headquarters. And so, 15,000 folks a year come through our doors, whereas initially we were a kind of a Boyle Heights, in my parish, eight gangs. Let's, meet the needs of these gang members so that they could redirect their lives. Now we serve the whole a county of Los Angeles.
Who's we initially? Who was that we?
Initially?
Yeah.
Well, we was the parish, and the women in the parish was mainly single mothers raising their kids. There were no men around, really, truly. And so we started to respond, and we started a school. They came to the church. Then we started a jobs program. Then we added, then after the unrest in 92, we kind of discovered social enterprises. So we began with a bakery, and then a tortilla factory followed a month later. And
well, tell us how that worked, and how did you build trust with gang members who had obviously broken with the society at large? They're creating their own social order. The dominant social order has failed, and so they create their own. And now along comes this priest and some moms and says, oh, boys, let's stop that. How'd that go?
Well, everything is relational in the end. And are you able to allow yourself to be reached by people? It's not about kind of reaching them. Yeah. And that's the great equalizer. So suddenly anybody who's the proud owner of a pulse who can receive people, listen to people, and then suddenly folks who do not feel very valuable are finding themselves favorable in the world and filled with nobility and dignity. But concretely, in the early days, I would hear somebody was shot, and I would visit three hospitals a day, and always visiting the wounded. Cut to 25 years later, the caliber of the weapons now was such that you don't have that many wounded. People are killed rather than being wounded, though. It certainly has decreased since the mid-90s.
So talk about the bakery and the idea, the inspiration for businesses, and tell us a little bit about that bakery. Who ran it?
We had 60 strategically hired gang members doing a variety of things. 1992 was the unrest. Our community would have been the most likely to explode, and it didn't. LA Times, sort of asked me a question why that was, and I said, I think it's because we had all these characters who would be most likely to participate in torching their own community, and they didn't. And so a movie producer named Ray Stark, who had $500 million, summoned me. And he said, how are you not going to go? And he was kind of a crusty old guy and has long died. But he said, what should I do with my money? And I said, well, I don't know. How about, you know, there's an abandoned bakery across the street from the church. It has ovens. Why don't we put hair nets on enemy gang members? They'll bake bread. We'll call it Homeboy Bakery, which was the extent of my business plan. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah. So then we were off and running. And then we started our next venture. I always say not everything worked. Homeboy Plumbing really was not hugely successful. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask you the sort of what works and what doesn't, but I got to understand first how you got rival gang members to A, put on hairnets, and then B, B, work side by side.
Yeah, well, you know, you deal with a kind of their own self-interest, which is they all want to have honest, clean money in their pocket. They want their moms, essentially, to be proud of them. They want their kids not to be ashamed of them. And they're human beings, so 95% of them want a reason to get up in the morning and a reason not to gangbang the night before. Then, you know, you'll say, but I'm going to have you work side by side with X, Y, and Z, and you rattle off names of enemies. And initially they'll say, well, I'll work with them. I'm sure not going to talk to them, which used to undo me in my early days. But now I know it's impossible for human beings to demonize people they know. So put them in the vicinity with each other, and that it's utterly reliable. All that animosity will fade away.
So what happened next then? So this business succeeded pretty quickly?
It got a lot of attention because it was a new idea. What if we were to invest in these folks rather than try to wipe them out or build more prisons to house them? So that was a novel idea, and it came at the time of the most heightened demonizing of that population. Right. So we had Daryl Gates, who was our chief of police, and famously wanting to just round him up and throw away the key. And so this was new, and so it didn't offer, to those who wanted to be tough on crime. This was the soft on crime approach. It offered, this is the truly smart on crime approach.
Right.
And then people started to believe it. And so I think, you know, if they say if you want to change anything, you have to change the metaphor. And Homeboy, at least in Los Angeles, changed the metaphor. People kind of went, oh, okay, I get it. Yeah. Let's not, that's futile what we're trying to do. And this will actually have a chance. So 92 had 1,000 gang-related homicides in LA County. It's been cut in half and cut in half again since then. And there isn't anybody in L.A. who doesn't think Homeboy Industries was a part of that.
So in addition to the jobs program, you offer a number of other services. Tell us how those other services work.
Well, you know, we keep adding things as we listen to people. So free tattoo removal. No place on the planet removes more than we do. We have a clinic with 3 laser machines and 47 volunteer doctors. So we're constantly doing that. And curriculum, GED, we still have a high school, a lot of classes, anger management, parenting, training programs. And then you have therapy. Everybody's in therapy, case management. The centerpiece of the program is an 18-month training program. But the idea there is not so much deliver services so much as to provide an opportunity for folks to heal, because a job is nice, but healing is sort of forever. Healing is the only thing that will keep a serious and violent offender from reoffending.
Well, it's interesting because we think about often when we talk about solutions for gang problems, we think about gang prevention. I mean, those are the terms that we usually use, which is some sense of sort of building a wall and diverting. But you're saying that really we have to focus on healing, that this individual, more than being diverted from whatever behavior there had been, needs to actually heal in their own heart and mind.
But, you know, 20 years ago it was more prevalent than now. You would get elected officials saying, you know, we can't do everything. And so let's do prevention. And so they would write off this current gang-involved group. And the, of course, the bad news there is that if you write them off, you're neglecting to acknowledge that they'll always have more influence on the guys coming up than you and I will. And so unless there's a simultaneity where you're doing at the same time addressing yeah. both groups, you're in fact undercutting your best efforts at prevention. So I'm heartened by the fact that people have given up that notion that, you know, it's sort of like saying in a family, do we feed them our kids or do we house them? And that's an unacceptable set right. of choices in a family. It can't be more acceptable in society.
Well, the other problem, I think, at the heart of the prevention-only idea is something you pointed to earlier, and that is a kind of mixed message that you send when putting people in prison, demonizing them as some kind of other. Once you're in a gang, you're some other force that threatens us all, and our only hope is to sequester you in the most harsh environment possible, which precisely plays into the reason you became a gang member to begin with. They don't need me. They don't want me. There's no place for me here. I guess I'll make my own society. You're actually reinforcing precisely the behavior you want to end.
Absolutely. And the sooner any society or city recognizes that, the more quickly you're on the path toward solution. And the undergirding principle in all this is that, by and large, we've forgotten that we belong to each other. So if you think there are sectors of society who are, in fact, the other, and these are the exceptions, these are the ones who don't belong to us, then you're always going to walk down a path that'll lead to some kind of dark rabbit hole that will never get you close to solving anything.
It's interesting. Some UCLA professors are leading a 5-year program to evaluate homeboy industries. And some preliminary outcomes suggest that homeboy experiences a recidivism rate. That is, people who are in this program or have gone through it have a recidivism rate of 30% of its trainees, which is 40% less than the recidivism rate of other. We were talking about comparing it to other intervention programs. So
we call it retention rate. So it's about 75%, you know, we have a 75% retention rate. So of those who go through our program, they don't reoffend. But in the federal government, you know, they deem a program as successful if it has a 30% retention rate, that if only 30% stay out of prison. That's because their expectations are so low, given how difficult it is, frankly, to deal with this population. But they haven't found a formula. And I think we have, frankly, because it's about healing the whole person. And then, you know, they've re-identified who they are in the world, and they leave us, and the world will throw at them what it will, but this time they're not toppled.
Well, two-thirds of the people who participate in the punitive criminal justice system, who are punished and sent to jail, repeat. So that's all you have to beat is that. If you beat two-thirds recidivism,
that's right.
That should be an easy mark, but I bet it's still a hard sell. Is this replicable, and are people listening to you? Is there, at least in L.A., for instance, a change of heart and a change of mind?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, we've evolved from getting death threats, bomb threats, and hate mail in my first 10 years.
Really?
And now we're obviously sort of hoisted on the shoulders of people in L.A. But having said that, you know, there are 47 programs in the country modeled on Homeboy. We don't let them use our name, and there are 11 programs outside the country. And so we call them members of what we call the Global Homeboy Network. So we gather every August and have a gathering where we share best practices and stuff. So they all have their own name, although each one will identify themselves as a partner in the Global Homeboy Network. But they're from Glasgow to Uganda to Wichita to Spokane. And they're programs that are born from below rather than have us airlift Homeboy into, you know, Durham. We'd much rather have Durham come to us and have a conversation. Maybe we come to them. And then people mix and match and adapt.
I mean, are there places where this just wouldn't work, or is it just a question of adapting it to the local culture?
Yeah, I don't think because at its core is this therapeutic community that holds people, and so that they can come to terms with what's been done to them and what they have done. And then healing begins. And unless there's that essential healing, they're going to relapse. So it's a little bit like recovery in a kind of drug and alcohol world. You know, sobriety, it would look like somebody just, here's a job and God bless you. But at Homeboy, we know that that won't work. And that we discovered that in our early days, that unless there's some kind of attachment repair or people kind of coming to terms with what's happened to them, the principle, of course, is damaged people will damage people unless you kind of break that cycle and have people heal.
So you talked about the healing for the individuals in the program. What about the community? People in gangs have done often very, very bad things. They've broken trust and hurt their communities. Is that part of, is that restoration, that restorative part of the program?
Yeah, there's a kind of a, you know, restorative justice is one of the principles, of course, and we have programs and groups that meet sometimes as long as a year, which has a lot of contact with victims, groups, and it's all part of the process of coming to terms with this. You know, in recovery, you know, they'll talk about romancing the drink, and it's a comparable thing.
Which means what?
Romancing the drink is kind of, remember that time when we, you know, got so drunk and you were wearing the lampshade and how did we get home and ha, ha, ha. But it doesn't acknowledge, you know, your wife left you, your kids hate you, and you lost your job. That you always want people to come back to the place of, no, no, mothers will never see their sons again. Yeah. And this really caused pain. So our navigators, which are homies, gang members, walk through the building and are always, you know, what they call ear hustling. And they're listening to conversations. And if anybody's romancing the drink, if you will, or talking about those the gang past in such a way that doesn't acknowledge what this really was about, then they get stopped and they people talk to them about it and say, we don't really do this here. And but that's the difference between sobriety is somebody who doesn't drink, but recovery is somebody who has insight about what was that. And
well, but often in restorative justice too, those people who have been hurt, the victims, the innocent victims, the moms and others, are brought in as well, and the perpetrator is made to confront that person. And then
and
we
do that to the extent
well.
That we can do it. It's
not
as you can imagine. It's
right.
Kind of a difficult thing. However, often enough, it's more likely that victims. And victimizers will be working together because they've all been shooting at each other for a long time. And you're working side by side in a bakery, you know, making rolls, and you're standing next to a guy who you used to shoot at.
So what are your hopes going forward? Are you seeing more openness? And we talked about it, obviously opened a few eyes in L.A. Is the national conversation, do you think, changing at all? Are you feeling
Oh, definitely. I mean, name another issue that is bipartisan and it's embracing. You know, I think this is it. The criminal justice system, from Newt Gingrich to folks who are, you know, diametrically opposed to him in every other way. But when it comes to this issue, people, so there's a common ground that, but it's a kind of strike while the iron's hot. I'm hoping we'll do that if, when people can get beyond all these other things and say, hey, we agree on this. So sentencing reform and dismantling of prisons and finding ways to keep, especially juveniles in the community, or we still are the only country on the planet that sentences children to die in prison. So, you know, and we're moving closer to eliminating that. But both left and right and Democrat and Republican agree on this, so we might as well run with it.
Good to have you on the program. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Father Greg Boyle, founder and executive director of Homeboy Industries, one of the largest gang intervention programs in the country. Father Greg's going to be giving a public talk at Gross Hall on Duke's West Campus tomorrow night at 6. And you can find out more details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a new documentary looks at the start of the conservation movement in the forests of Western North Carolina. Stay tuned.